Welcome to the newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. On today's show, Citizen Warrior, an autobiographical account of Jean Merritt's lifelong efforts to improve Wilmington. Merritt fought to change the downtown nightlife scene, pushing for liquor by the drink while also evicting topless bars and sex shops. His next battle was an industrial coal pile planned where the modern-day Riverwalk and concert venue exist. And then there was the struggle to bring I-40 to Wilmington, and later, to keep the county from selling its hospital. Merritt is joined today by co-author John Meyer, who helped cover these events as a veteran Star News reporter and editor. I'm Ben Schachman. That's coming up on The Newsroom in just a moment. Stay with us. From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we're speaking with Jean Merritt, a developer and community advocate who has spent most of his long and interesting career working to make Wilmington a better place. That's been contentious work at times, pitting him against moralists, organized criminals, industrial giants, and perhaps most dauntingly, the status quo. His fans call him outspoken. And I can't really repeat on the air what his critics sometimes say, but I know he's done more than most to change the place I call home. In a lot of ways, for me, this conversation is a long time in the making. I decided to move to Wilmington in 2003 on the advice of a friend who had just gotten a job on the final season of Dawson's Creek. That's the almost comically melodramatic but hugely popular TV show that was being shot here. As the show wrapped, a lot of the crew were excitedly hoping to keep working on One Tree Hill, another high school ensemble drama that was shooting a pilot. As I was still wrapping up my college career in New Jersey, rumors began to fly that the show would move to Vancouver, Canada, where subsidies and lower production costs had already enticed a host of other successful shows. That's the reason, after all, that no matter where in North America that agents Mulder and Scully went to investigate an X-File, it always kind of looked like Vancouver. Then, all of a sudden, it was announced. One Tree Hill would stay in Wilmington. And it stayed there for 9 seasons, pumping tens of millions of dollars into the local economy and creating tons of jobs, including for me. I moved into my first Wilmington apartment on North 4th Street shortly after the announcement, and one of my first jobs in town was working craft services on the Screen Gems backlot. I remember standing at a hot dog shop on Front Street, drinking a PBR, and watching One Tree Hill's pilot episode. And I asked, what had saved the day? And someone told me, not what, who? Jean Merritt. As a 23-year-old and a recent transplant to Wilmington, I didn't know who that was. Over a decade later, though, I had left and come back to the Port City, and I had started reporting for Port City Daily. Jean Merritt's name kept coming up, whether I was digging into film subsidies, or looking to understand the arcane politics of interstate highway construction, or digging into the history of voter-initiated ballots. Over the years, I've collected many stories about Jean Merritt. Some that I could verify, I've published. Others, more apocryphal, I save for cocktail parties. So last year, when I ran into Merritt at a downtown watering hole, and he told me he was writing a book, a memoir of sorts, I was happy to hear it. Citizen Warrior is that book. Published last month, it is an autobiography, but also a manual on community advocacy and activism. It offers case studies in resilience and creativity, when to hold them and when to bluff, and how to keep at it without losing your sense of humor. Merritt tapped John Meyer, a veteran Star News reporter and editor who had covered many of the key battles Merritt had fought as a co-author, editor, and fact-checker. He joins us today as well to bring receipts and to keep Merritt honest. So, to start, I wanted Merritt to take us back to Wilmington in the 1970s. There was no I-140, no Mayfair, no Independence Mall, and a downtown scene dominated by topless bars and sex shops. One of Merritt's first campaigns was in favor of something called Liquor by the Drink, which would allow restaurants and bars to sell drinks like gin and tonics or scotch and sodas. The alternative, up to that point, was people bringing their own bottles of hard liquor with them wherever they went, in brown bags. So you were here. What was it like? What was Wilmington like at that point?
It was a small, little, simple town.
Slightly racy.
very bracy, just not a lot to do. You know, before Liquor by the Drink, by the way, I can remember there were only four or five restaurants that you could go out to eat in this town. And we did Liquor by the Drink. We called it brown bagging back then. And of course, we had the famous poster that we put out during our campaign of the drunk. Love that poster.
As John Meyer recalls, the opposition came from conservative Christians.
Was the resistance moralistic? Was it a public health thing? Was it just kind of Stasi tradition?
There's a religious-based group that called themselves the Christian Action League.
Yes.
And they took an absolutist position that all alcohol is bad.
Right.
Which I think really played into the campaign, the poster that Gene mentioned, because that showed that under brown bagging there is more chance of alcohol abuse than if it's carefully controlled.
I mean, you know, and I made that argument in a debate, a public debate. Can't remember where it was, but the Christian Action League was there, and I was there as chairman of the Liquor by the Drink Committee, or Citizens for a Better Choice, or whatever we called it.
Better Way.
Yeah. Better Way. And I said, you know, it's interesting that you talk about that, but I made that very point that which is worse, someone that gets drunk and goes out and kills somebody in his car or, you know, somebody that has a couple of drinks?
There was one other area of opposition, not as important, but one of the co-chairs of the committee, Cammy Bain, was married to a lawyer who was a junior partner of John Birney, who was a big deal politically in those days. And he gave her a hard time because he didn't want to have to pay individual prices for cocktails. He thought it was more economical to brown bag.
Isn't that funny?
So the emphasis of the campaign was on younger people and on newcomers to Wilmington. And it obviously it worked.
Newcomers to Wilmington are always key demo.
You know, John really, I guess I had not suppressed it, but I had not really looked at the bigger picture of how important this was. I mean, bars and restaurants are a huge part of this economy in this big area. Huge.
That's the reason half the people I know are here. They either came and had a good time at a bar or they came here and worked at a bar.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, but like I say, when we were working in the campaign, there were very few places.
And once it went on the local ballot, it was like a 2-1, like a landslide.
Right.
The next challenge was the adult entertainment business. Merritt had recently taken the lead at the Downtown Area Revitalization Effort, or DARE. That's the forerunner of today's Wilmington Downtown, Inc. Merritt and Meyer helped explain what happened next.
When I first started out, there were adult bookstores and topless bars. And obviously, I saw that as very negative for the future of downtown Wilmington, as did some other people. But there was a certain amount of lethargy going on at the time. I mean, we were down, and everybody sort of was living with this downness. Does that make any sense?
A lot of empty storefronts, for example. So for a landlord, rent to a sex shop or have no rent, so they rented to the sex shops.
A humorous anecdote, the famous Bob Jenkins, the tour guide in downtown, who was a character beyond all belief and knew everyone and all that. And he threw a cocktail party for all of the downtown prostitutes at what is now Ibiza, that building. He threw a cocktail party for all of the downtown prostitutes and invited me to go to the party and introduced me to all the prostitutes and said, Mr. Barrett here wants you to leave downtown Wilmington. It's hilarious. It shocked me.
Yeah.
And that was really funny. So that was one issue. That cleaned itself up pretty well. But the fundamental issue was the adult bookstores and topless bar. And the adult bookstores, and I have this in the book, that I did not realize how bad of people they were. And so I started the thing, the creativity, again, that we promote in this book. The creativity was I came up with the idea of how are we going to get rid of these adult bookstores? they're in these buildings and they're paying rent to the owners, and the owners don't want to do anything, and yada, yada, yada. So I came up with the idea of getting DARE Incorporated to buy the buildings that the Dolphus bookstores were in, evict the bookstores, and then resell the buildings. It was, I thought, a very good idea, and everyone else thought it was too, but we didn't have any money or credit. Turns out Thomas H. Wright of Wright Chemical Corporation and Chandler's Wharf.
I was going to say, who he built out the the south end of the river.
Thomas Wright, who was became one of my dearest friends, he said, "Gene, go to the bank and borrow the money. I'll sign the note." So I started going to the bank and borrowing money, buying buildings, evicting the Topless bars and adult bookstores, and putting restrictive covenants on the deed. I could show them to you. It says no adult entertainment businesses. And the funny part about it all was the definition of adult entertainment business was pretty hilarious, pretty graphic, actually.
Oh, my. Well, all right, so we'll bleep this if we have to, but what was the definition?
Well, it defined certain body parts that could not be visible, those kinds of things.
Yeah, it was really kind of something I was surprised at, quite frankly. Anyway.
But the definition that really made the difference after the sales was amending the zoning ordinance so they couldn't come back.
But that was the critical thing, is that we were able to do that and amend the zoning ordinance and anyway, turn it all around. But there was one particular guy that ran a particular business downtown that I kind of knew him personally. And it turned out he asked me to come see him one day. And he said, "You better get off of this wagon you're on, and leave us alone." And as it turned out, to make a long story short, he threatened my life. He did it in a subtle way, but he got the point across. I might be dumb, but I'm not stupid. I got the point where, you know, it would not be for your health purposes to continue this. Turns out that what I did not know was that some of the businesses were involved in organized crime. So we had an organized crime operation going on and selling adult bookstores.
Well, you're still alive half a century later, so you must have navigated that somehow.
To the detriment of a lot of people, I have no doubt. Detriment and dismay.
The next battle was the coal pile. At the time, city and county leaders saw much of the Wilmington waterfront as an industrial area, including a former World War II shipyard, where few people saw the potential for the kind of residential and recreational development we have today. Merritt thought the coal pile would be a disaster, and he was hell-bent on preventing it. But that required him to get creative, which is what makes this one of his and my favorite stories.
So I want to ask, and you and I have actually talked about this before, and I got a chance to write about it once, which was a ton of fun. But the coal pile.
Oh, and that's my favorite story.
And the loop, and the loophole.
That's my favorite story, Ben. John would agree. There's nothing that can compare with that story.
I do have to say, I had a file of my news clippings in those days, which I put the topless bar and porn shop stuff in, but also the coal pile stuff. The heading on the file was pornography / dirty stuff. So the coal pile was the dirtiest thing that threatened downtown.
Do you want me to give you the story?
Give me the story, yeah.
All right, I'm the executive director of DARE Incorporated. This is like 1979, I believe.
80 and then into 81.
There's an article in Star News that said, "Clean Coal," love that name, "Clean Coal Terminals of Ghent, Kentucky, announced that they would be coming to Wilmington, North Carolina, and that would be importing several million tons of coal a year and putting it down on the riverfront down there where the convention center is now. And I said, holy Moses, this could be a problem. So I started doing a little research around the country with other towns, And basically, the word got back to me, if that coal pile goes in, you can kiss the future of downtown Wilmington goodbye.
And the timing was not good because you had the Independence Mall.
Had just opened.
Had just opened.
A huge competitor for
absolutely
for commerce.
Sears.
Well, we
Sears,
lost our department stores.
Right. Belk moved there.
Sears had moved earlier to Hanover Shopping Center in the 60s. Belk's and Penny's moved to Independence Mall in 79. So this was, everything was going away at the time. So you had an environment in which the primary politicians in the town, the city council and the county commissioners, looked at downtown Wilmington as an industrial place, an industrial waterfront, not a commercial place at all, okay? And so I was fighting that mentality. And so when I started pushing back about the coal pile, people told me that they were going to get me fired from Deere Incorporated. And, you know, one of the people that really was negative on me was Estelle Lee. Do you know who she is?
Yes, she has a little street named after her now by the Chamber of Commerce.
Funny thing, right around the corner from where the convention center is and where that coal pile would have been.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
It was her land.
Yeah.
Well, next to hers, because Railroad and Almont Shipping both saw development.
Almont Shipping, yeah. Okay, so anyway, I started getting a lot of pushback. You know, I started getting worried about it, and I'm thinking, I don't have much time here. They're talking about doing this in a matter of weeks. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, what the heck am I going to do? And so I got my father involved, as I have on numerous occasions, to sort of be the front man a little bit. And what did we call the group? I forgot the name of the group. But we formed a group that was anti-coal pile. And my father was the president, and I was the executive director. I was running everything, but my father was a little bit of the face of it. So time starts running out, and then, like, I am facing 2 weeks before the first coal pile comes, and I said, I'm in trouble. And so I started, this is the creativity piece of it, if you will, and the whole crazy part of it. I said, I wonder if there's anything in the general statutes of the state of North Carolina that would in any way allow for us to do anything, you know, whatever. But, I mean, it was like a stab in the dark. So as I write in the book, about 2 o'clock in the morning, and with the aid of Jack Daniels and ginger ale, I discovered the skies opened and the light came. And God came down from the heaven and said, this is it, son. It said that the enabling, that the on the books of general statutes, enabling legislation had been passed that allowed North Carolina cities to amend the city code upon a vote of the people. And ironically and strangely, I found out that Wilmington had already
was in the city charter.
The city charter. And you wouldn't have thought they would have done that, but they had. Anyway, what I'm saying is they had checked off on it. So I'm saying, okay. So I immediately call for an election.
The city charter required a petition to get 25% of the number of people who had voted in the most recent election. And back then, as now, turnout for municipal elections was pretty paltry. Just a few thousand people had voted, meaning that with somewhere around 1,000 signatures, Merritt could force an election. And he got them easily.
I forced an election to occur.
Yes.
That's when we put the poster up, I only wanted one drink, we had the bottle. All this time, everyone was threatening to run me out of town. Mm-hmm. The city council was not in favor of this. My board of directors at Deere Incorporated was not in favor of this.
They just saw economic development.
They said, maybe not downtown, but we'll help you find another spot.
So anyway, we had the election, and we killed them, and we forced the city to amend the city code. Even after the election, they didn't want to do it, and we threatened a lawsuit against them. I mean, I'm telling you, it was how bad it was. And so what they did is that this was a M1 manufacturing. Light manufacturing zone. We got them to amend the code disallowing coal transfer facilities, and we killed it. Greatest thing I've ever been involved in.
For fans of direct democracy, Merritt's victory here has a bittersweet postscript. About 35 years later, Wilmington City Council would quietly close the loophole with a subtle but significant change. Now, you can still file for a petition, but you now need 25% of the registered voters, not just the most recent turnout. That means you'd need something like tens of thousands of signatures, making a petition an order of magnitude harder to get than it was back in the early 1980s.
Because we were so successful and did it so easily, that obviously worried the politicians and said, God, they might do something else here and do something else that would be good that we don't like. They changed it to 25%.
Interesting how the powers that be were against both of these referendums. The liquor authorities in New Hanover County all poo-pooed the prospect of liquor by the drink. They were wrong. And, of course, the business and political communities were all for the coal transfer facility, and they were wrong about that, too. The voters prevailed in both cases.
The voters prevailed.
I love it. I do think it's interesting just how much direct democracy scared them.
Yeah, exactly.
That was direct democracy, mm-hmm. if there ever has been.
Petition could have forced the city council to amend the zoning right there, but they said, no, we must have a referendum.
They forced the vote.
It's fascinating.
It's a wonderful story, and I'm glad, I'm honored that I was involved with it.
All right. Well, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be back with more from Gene Merritt and John Meyer about their book, Citizen Warrior. I'm Ben Schockman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schockman. Thanks for staying with us for more of our conversation with developer and community advocate Gene Merritt and reporter and editor John Meyer, who recently published Citizen Warrior, a memoir of Merritt's years of efforts to help reshape Wilmington. One of the toughest and most complex projects that Merritt was involved in was the fight to get Interstate 40 to come from Raleigh to Wilmington. Merritt, along with his father and brother, had lobbied for years to bring real highway infrastructure to Wilmington, which had long been practically cut off from the rest of the state. They'd gotten traction with Democratic Governor Jim Hunt, until it looked like things might fall apart, or at least way behind.
So I-40 exists, goes all the way to Barstow, California.
Right.
Yes.
Everyone's seen those signs.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I know some folks who moved here from Barstow.
That's funny.
There was a point in time where it looked like the path of I-40 would have taken it towards, like, New Bern.
John, address that if you want to.
Yeah, the state had been very slow to fund interstate highways. And by the mid-70s, the extension of Interstate 40 just from Durham to Raleigh and then to I-95 was still unbuilt. And the path that the state had determined would have taken it to near Smithfield, which would have almost inevitably meant that any further extension would have gone down to Morehead City and New Bern. So there was a huge fight in the late 70s just to get that extension of I-40 to 95
to
moved south to Benson.
Right.
We had to get it to Benson. We had bumper stickers, I-40 to Benson.
Yeah. So there's a quote you were reading off mics on KMN. I wonder if you could reenact that, because that is a great quote. Because for people who don't understand how isolated Wilmington was.
During my time as city editor, I assigned some reporters to do a story about talk to people who go to Raleigh a lot and find out what their recommended route is. And we probably talked to a dozen people and got at least half a dozen different answers, because there was no good best route. So they talked to Gene. This was Christmas Day, 1983. Okay, so the interstate was under construction, but at the timeline, as of then, according to the Hunt administration, it wouldn't be finished until 1994, 11 years in the future. So when the reporter asked Gene about this, he said, take a City of Wilmington bus to the city limits, Merritt said. Then get a four-wheel drive vehicle to take to Wallace, get yourself a mule train from Wallace to Smithfield, and then walk on from Smithfield to Raleigh. The mule train made it into the headline. Now, it was Gene's father, who, of course, had gone to Raleigh a lot when he was in the legislature, and he put it a little bit differently. He said he hoped before he died that he could drive to Raleigh and not have to stop for a tractor or a hog.
I thought he said school bus. He said
maybe it was a school bus.
A school bus or a hog.
Mm-hmm. So this fight took years and years.
12 years we lobbied.
Yep.
Yeah, and there was a moment where Hunt kind of backed out of it.
Well,
what happened there?
A couple of things.
Well, here's what happened, in my opinion. John can disagree or agree. Hunt was, among everything, a politician, with all due respect. I mean, he was a politician running for public office. So he was running for public office against a formidable opponent. And so in my opinion, what he did was take, as my father used to say, all roads are political, which means that every road that gets built, there's a lot of politics involved in it, okay? So what Hunt was doing was giving highway money away to get political favoritism. That's what was going on.
So there were like a couple of stretches where almost a dirt road would suddenly become a four-lane highway.
Well, Charlie Rose had come up with enough federal money in a carefully defined arrangement that it could be used at a very favorable ratio, 95% federal, only 5% state, best ratio that existed.
I think our state legislator would kill for that.
But it could only be used for Interstate 40 because that was what they called a priority primary highway. And Hunt, who was busily running against Jesse Helms for the Senate, thought, well, you know, if I take this money and spread it around the state, it'll be better for me. And so though that meant that the 95-5 ratio wouldn't hold, it would have been maybe 90-10 or even 75-25.
It was a betrayal. He betrayed us.
Meanwhile, we had allies in the legislature who were trying to get a vote on this because the General Assembly could have overridden Hunt and the Board of Transportation. But one of Hunt's allies, a legislator from Raleigh, played a switcheroo. He would not let our people speak in front of the Appropriations Committee. And then he said something that really he probably shouldn't have, because he said, the problem we're having is that if there isn't enough state money to match the federal money, we may have to make it up with new highway taxes. That's a lot more important than whether we have some little road to New Hanover County.
So, don't get no respect. And I think that you make that comment, and it's really a very important thing, is that the importance of I-40 being a game changer is that it took Wilmington away from isolation and put it into the flow, as a simplistic statement. Mm-hmm. And now look at what's happened. I mean, everything has changed. And I think that my father used to say, you know, we didn't have a lot of, they didn't care about us in Raleigh.
Yeah. And there was pomp and circumstance and celebration when, I mean, there were thousands of people when I-40 finally opened, right? I mean, there was, even people who were here, even people who might, given the benefit of hindsight, some people wish I-40 had been, never built. At the time, this was cause for great celebration.
Well, yes, it
absolutely.
Was.
Absolutely. I mean, again, not having to stop for a hog, what's wrong with that?
People who graduated from high school or college in the 60s, 70s, even into the 80s, typically had to leave town to get good jobs. The economy was just stagnant here. It was certainly true when I came to town in the late 70s.
When I-40 opened to traffic in Wilmington in the summer of 1990, it changed the port city, for better or worse.
For some, it was the last nail in the coffin for Wilmington as a cozy little town near the beach. For others, though, it was the beginning of an economic boom. By the time I got to Wilmington in the early 2000s, I-40 had been open for over a decade, and the city had changed dramatically. And part of that was the film industry, centered around Screen Gem Studios. As I said at the top, this was essentially the reason I ended up in Wilmington in the first place. Now, over 20 years later, I get the chance to ask Merritt how One Tree Hill was saved as a port city production.
They had committed to go to Canada.
They committed to go to Vancouver. Everything was filming in Vancouver back then.
And do you want to hear the story?
I want to hear the story, yeah.
All right. I used to hang out in a bar on South Front Street. I will not mention the name of it right now. But I used to have a drinking buddy who worked in the film industry. And I'm not going to mention his name. And so I am in the bar one day at 5 o'clock, as usual. And he's in there and said, I'm out of a job. He worked for One Tree Hill. He was in the film industry. I said, what do you mean? He says, they're leaving. One Tree Hill is leaving Wilmington. And this is where, I don't know, John asked, what makes me do what I do, or what makes people like me do what I do? I said, the hell they are. I'm not standing for that. I've got to do something. I've got to fight. I've got to do something. And so this was an immediate decision. They were leaving right away, and I figured, had to do something. So I called a meeting between Frank Capra, Johnny Griffin.
Frank Capra Jr., right?
Frank mm-hmm. Capra Jr., Johnny Griffin, who was the film manager.
Commissioner. Mm-hmm.
John Merritt, my brother, who was the politician and the, you know, and Danny McComas, the state senator, and myself. There were five of us, okay? We got together and said, what is it going to take to keep these people here? And it said, money.
Just $750,000, that's all.
In $2,003.
We raised, mm-hmm. okay, Danny and John stole. I'm being facetious when I say stole. They didn't steal it, but there was $500,000 in the state's fund to promote film. They got every cent of it. I volunteered to go to the city of Wilmington and ask them for $125,000, and someone else at the table went to the county for $125,000. We raised $750,000 in 8 days. Gave the money to Griffin. He went and bribed them and saved One Tree Hill. They were here another 10 years. Tremendous economic impact. Wasn't that sweet? Now, that
amazing,
was
amazing.
Me being a hard butt. I just didn't want to accept failure.
What my favorite little wrinkle of this, and it's in the book, so I'm not talking out of school, was that Harper Peterson, who was mayor at the time,
you
were not on great terms. When you were in luck, though.
Well, let me say this. Harper Peterson and I, it was fairly well known that we're not the best of friends. I figured at that time if I went to ask for the $125,000 from the city, Harper would turn me down just to make me look bad, okay? And Harper, if you're out there listening, you know what I'm talking about. Harper was out of town. And I went to Sterling Cheatham, the city manager.
Yeah,
and he immediately gave me the money.
Yeah,
isn't that funny?
Yeah,
I know that. I think technically he managed to retroactively stick it into the coming year's budget.
Yeah.
But I heard it just like he had it in a drawer.
There was a check written. I'm talking about right on the spot. So Harper, thank God, was out of town and didn't have a chance to defeat the idea.
And Sterling clearly saw the need
to his benefit.
The taxes from that TV show would refill the city's coffers
as it turned
pretty nicely.
Out, yeah. That was pretty prophetic. I mean, I don't know exactly. It seems like I saw an article in Star News or somewhere a few years ago that talked about the economic impact of One Tree Hill.
I mean, it was 8 or 9 seasons, and it was something like $20 million a season by the time, right? So you can do the math.
Not too many people know this story, though, interestingly enough. It's very interesting. I'm going to say this, is that some of the people in the film industry apparently were embarrassed by the fact that all of this happened, and they tried to deny that I was involved. Could you believe that?
Sour grapes.
Sour grapes, big time.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to say, no, this didn't happen that way. It didn't happen that way. Well, I'm telling you, that's exactly the way it happened. It's the way I told it to you.
All right. Well, we need to take one more quick break. But we'll be back with more from Gene Merritt and John Meyer as we talk about the hospital sale and what makes a citizen warrior. I'm Ben Schachman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us for more of our conversation with developer and community advocate Gene Merritt and reporter and editor John Meyer, who recently published Citizen Warrior, a memoir of Merritt's years of efforts to help shape Wilmington. Through perseverance or creativity, Merritt had a lot of victories, but his attempts to stop the sale of New Hanover County Regional Medical Center was not one of them. The process began in the summer of 2019, and Merritt was quick to get involved.
I formed an organization called Save Our Hospital Incorporated, brought together what I consider some very fine people who are concerned about this matter in the community. And we basically just too much money, too much power, too much political. It was a sawed-up deal, as my father used to call it, a sawed-up deal. And there are a few local politicians that I would blame to having a lot to do with that problem.
But that also, I think, stemmed from the deterioration of daily newspaper journalism.
Yes.
There was no longer a strong editorial voice. And just as important, there was no longer the level of reporting needed to get deep down into the finances behind this and tell the story of who stood to benefit, who stood to lose, and that just wasn't happening. So we can see the difference between the Crusades of the late 20th century and how the hospital thing turned out.
I have often awakened in the middle of the night with the idea that I would get a lawyer and sue to force a number of people to give their financial statements. Somebody got paid off, in my opinion. To me, with all due respect, I believe it was a crooked deal.
Between the summer of 2019 and the spring of 2021, I spent a lot of time investigating the hospital sale, and I've heard plenty of allegations against the commissioners who ultimately voted to sell NHRMC to Novant Health. Merritt was, and still is, particularly critical of then-County Commissioner Woody White. But I can say a lot of people pointed at smoke, but I never found a smoking gun, and there was no evidence that I could find that the process had been corrupt or that anyone had been paid off. I did come to understand the reasons for the sale from talking to healthcare experts, not politicians, and I learned that, essentially, a county-owned hospital was almost inevitably going to lose in the competition for new patients because the county could not invest major resources into facilities in the greater southeastern North Carolina area. A more important question to me was whether Novant was the best option, or just the buyer offering the most cash on the barrelhead. Were they prepared to handle the pandemic? And beyond that, operating a major regional trauma hospital that serves 6 or 7 counties? The process, though public and deliberative, still felt rushed to the public and me. There were so many questions we never got a chance to answer. And I've often thought about what Meyer just said, about how a daily newspaper, like the Star News in its prime, can get involved in major community issues.
And John, maybe your perspective would be good here. In a time where there was a strong editorial voice and a newsroom with maybe 12 reporters.
12?
Or is it a 3?
I had 16 at the
16, sorry.
The prime of time there.
Well, let's say the 16, you know, a fully complement mm-hmm. of proper reporters.
Right, and that didn't count the sports and feature and other folks. This is just the news side.
Right.
Hard news.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we don't have that.
It's gone. The death of journalism, in my opinion.
Well, one of the things we don't see anymore, you know, it's the easiest thing in journalism is to go to a meeting and report on what's said at the meeting. But during the heyday of the Star, and I'm pleased to say I think our high point was the 1990s, we had reporters who were doing deep dives into these issues, digging out the numbers, finding out who was beholden to whom, kind of laying out the where the bodies are buried. And that takes time, and it requires editors who are willing to let a reporter not file daily stories for a week or two while working on something that has to be dug into.
So I just want to ask, hypothetically, with all that, with editors willing to give journalists the time to really dig into this stuff and, you know, a full complement, a full-sized newsroom, with all that, does the hospital sale go the same way?
Probably not. I would just point to how both aggressive investigative reporting complemented with aggressive skeptical opinion writing made a difference in so many of these other stories. And with that missing, that difference has been critical.
I mean, back in the day in the 80s,
the editorial board was very direct, I think, and had a definite opinion. For people for whom that would be shocking in their local paper, like how did that work? What was the process of an editorial board come out swinging?
In those days, the editorial board consisted of three people: the publisher, the big boss of the newspaper, the executive editor, that was Andy Anderson, who had that job for many years. And then the editorial page editor was Chuck Reese, who happens to be a high school classmate of Gene's. So he's a native Wilmingtonian, went away for a while, came back in 1980, and he knew very well what the issues were, what was at stake, and how important getting that highway here was. So he had good, strong support both from Andy Anderson and from a series of publishers. Now, of course, a newspaper publisher, at least in those days, was as much involved in economic development of the community as he was in running the newspaper. So all of those publishers were strong backers of getting the interstate built here, as well as things like liquor by the drink and downtown redevelopment and so forth.
Well, Ben, along those lines, in the book I talk about it, but I think it's important to mention, and I have mentioned on numerous occasions, I would not be where I am today without the support, the editorial support of the Star, Wilmington Star News. I wouldn't. It was invaluable to me that they supported me and backed me at everything that I ever did. And they played a very important role in my success.
It was a very powerful voice in the community. I think it was, there was a time when the editorial board would be able to say, because they were well connected with the community, you know, they might risk alienating one out of every three people with the opinion, but they would say, this is what's best for the community.
This was, they did what they thought was in the best interest of the community, regardless of whose feet they stepped on.
And sometimes didn't hesitate to insult powerful people like the governor, like with Andy's Christmas column, "Yes, Virginia, the highway exists, even though you can't drive on it."
Yeah, I mean, there was a sense of humor, a sense of personality, pugilism when necessary.
I don't know what I would have done without Chuck Reese, quite frankly. I mean, he was, and Andy Anderson. I got along great with them. And they weren't trying to be nice to me because they liked me. They believed in what I was doing.
Okay, so I don't want to end on the hospital because that's, that's sad.
It's a bummer.
It's a bummer.
Mm-hmm. Bummer. Fair enough.
I do want to add, the title of this is Citizen Warrior, which is you lay out some prescriptions for how to go about doing that. And I feel like maybe you are hoping there will be another generation of folks with that spirit. So
that's the purpose of the book.
If you had to, I know there's actually an instructional list of what makes one. But from your point of view, like if someone came to you and said, I've had it with this. I want to do something about it. What would your advice be?
Are you willing to risk your reputation and your financial condition to get involved?
And if they say, if they run screaming, okay. But if they say yes and they're still there, then what?
then you need to call a spade and get in and start fighting. I think one of the problems that we have a lot of these days is people complain, but they don't follow up. Follow up is a critical issue in any business, but especially in this sort of thing. You have to look for the details, and you have to be, the number one thing is you have to be committed to this community, to the best welfare of everyone that lives in it. That's the number one thing. But if you want to get involved, get some help. Get some help. Find someone that can help you. Go find a Gene Merritt or somebody like that that'll get out there and fight with you. I might have made a few enemies here and there, but, you know, I think I've also made a lot of friends, with all due respect.
Well, in 1984, Chuck Reese wrote an editorial mostly about Interstate 40, but also harking back to the coal pile. And it was specifically about Gene and his father and his brother, and said, what in the world makes these Merritts do what they do? And he closed by saying that what really mattered was, quote, to have the nerve to do something. And sometimes it's like somebody once said, 90% of success is showing up. Sometimes you just got to get off your duff and say, no, I'm not going to leave this for someone else to do. I'm going to do something about it myself.
Yeah, and people have asked me, and John and I have asked the rhetorical question, why do I do what I do? And I'm not sure I have a complete simplistic answer to that, except to say, because I feel like I have to. If that makes any sense, I feel obligated to this community to do what I have done. I feel I'm a citizen of this community. I'm a loyal Wilmingtonian, New Hanover County, North Carolina, and American. I'm loyal to those entities. And I feel like I have to do what I need to do to protect the best interests of the people that live in it, if that makes any sense. But you know, I and my brother John, you know, we joke about what makes us do what we do. And yet we've done it and we've been successful at it. So you tell me.
Well, those are my questions and the things I wanted to touch on. Anything else you guys would want to add about the book or the broader themes that we're talking about here?
I think the book would be good for a lot of younger people that don't know the history of Wilmington. I think it would be very helpful if more younger people in this community read this book, that would give them a perspective on where we've been. I mean, it's like, for example, the people that ride down Water Street on the river and look at all the apartments and on the convention center and all that, they don't realize that none of that would have been there if the coal pile had come in. None of it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I talk to people constantly who have no idea about how we didn't have liquor by the drink, how we didn't have an interstate highway, how we didn't have a convention center, how we didn't have a viable, safe, thriving downtown, how we didn't have a river walk. All these things had to be fought for. They had to be paid for. They had to be accomplished against pretty stiff opposition in many cases. People who saw their own profit short term, but nevertheless their own profit at the detriment of the broader community. And that required that battles had to be fought.
A community leader has to be consistent and persistent. They have to not give up. You cannot give up. You cannot accept failure. Now, you don't win every battle, but you've got to try to win the war, if that makes any sense.
Keep fighting. Win every battle you can, and if you can't win them all, go on to the next one.
I will say this about whatever I do. I care. I honestly care about my fellow man and my fellow citizen in the communities in which I live. I do care about them, all of them. And so when I do something, I'm doing it not just for me, but for them as well. And I know that sounds simplistic, but it's really, really true. I'm proud of where our community has come over the last 50 years.
All right. Well, that's just about all the time we have for this edition of The Newsroom. Thanks to developer and community advocate Gene Merritt and retired Star News reporter and editor John Meyer. The book is Citizen Warrior from Wilmington's own Dramtree Books. We'll have links on the page for more information. Thanks, as always, to WHQR's program director, Ken Campbell, for technical assistance for today's show. Music was provided by If These Trees Could Talk and Blue Dot Sessions. And if you have comments, concerns, or just an idea for a future show, you can email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.